Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spark Radio Show, filled with strategies, possibilities, action, resources, and knowledge that may be the spark of a better solution to ignite a positive change in your life. The number to call if you have questions for Melanie or any of our guests is area code 347-215-8390. Now, here's your host, Ms. Melanie.
Hello, and welcome to or welcome back to Spark Radio. I am your host, Ms. Melanie, and I want to thank you so much for investing the valuable minutes of your life to learn with me here at Spark. And tonight, we will be discussing sparks of positive control in small spaces with Paula M. Kramer. And before we get started, I do want to invite you to just take a moment to breathe deeply, to focus on where you are in this space, and open yourself up to learning something new or maybe relearning from a wonderful, amazing woman that I so enjoyed discussing this interview in our planning session. She has so many wonderful things to share. So I'm going to give her as much time as possible. And there are resources in the description of this episode that you can click to learn more about Paula M. Kramer. And for now, I will just say that her life's journey is inspiring, and her resources are powerful. And so I'm going to introduce you to Paula M. Kramer. Hi, Paula. Welcome.
Hi, Melanie. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Paula, I'm so excited to spend this hour talking with you and giving you the opportunity to share the amazing journey that you've had to go from to finding your voice, to from your work in soft skills mastermind area, and to help people know that how they can take positive control in small spaces. So what is it you would like listeners to know about you, Paula?
I have survived 3 life-altering tragedies. By age 28, I was coping with 3 life-altering long-term tragedies. My mother tried to kill me twice when I was a baby. I was a baby. I have memories, and I have found research that shows that babies as young as 3 months can have visual memories of trauma. I was a baby when my mother tried to kill me. When I was 12 years old, a boy in school pulled my chair out from under me to get my attention because he had a crush on me. I landed hard on my tailbone, and medical professionals misdiagnosed the injury for 33 years. If anyone in the audience has a child in their life, please tell them to never pull a chair out from under anyone. Some people are instantly paralyzed. I'm lucky I can walk. And my husband died when our daughter was 8 months old. I was 28 and had all of that to cope with.
Yeah, even with just one of those, but to have all 3 of those happen
all
at
three,
the young
right.
age of 28.
Yep. Dealing with all of them still.
Is there anything else
still
you'd like to add?
Well,
before
I
we dive into other questions.
I have gone from the silenced voice of my childhood to an international voice. So it's possible to overcome a life like mine and make something good out of it.
It's a powerful message just by itself. So listeners, if you have to leave early and don't get back, that is a very, very powerful takeaway, that you do have control over the perception
right.
and the actions that you take following tragedies.
Right.
So, Paula,
yes,
can you tell us a bit about that? Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about the journey that you have taken to discover and step into your current purpose and passion in your life?
Well, I survived my childhood by listening to positive words I could trust, speaking positive words to others, and speaking positive words others could trust, and speaking positive words to myself. My father loved me, so I had that, but my mother was a narcissist who emotionally abused everybody, and so he became a quiet alcoholic to cope with this emotional abuse. He'd go off to his job, come home, and drink 2 to 3 quarts of beer a night to bury his feelings. My father really loved my mother. My mother never loved anyone. My father really loved my mother, so this was really hard on him, what she did to him. And because you can't keep feelings buried, his feelings would erupt at times into rages that lasted for hours or days. And in one of those rages, he unintentionally broke my older sister's arm. So I was afraid of my father. I was terrified of my mother, but I was afraid of my father. And I did not grow up thinking to myself, Mom tried to kill me, because that would have made me insane. I buried all the memories of the murder attempts by separating them into separate physical, mental, and emotional pieces. So I had all these clues throughout my life until I was 42 and put them all together. But I had to live with my mother. I could not live with her. And so because I was terrified of my mother, unconsciously, and afraid of my father, I had to develop soft skill strategies to use outside the family. And so I started in school, well, in the neighborhood with the other kids, but in school. The first time I felt safe with an adult was when I was 7 years old with my first second grade teacher. She got married during the year and moved away. I have no memory of the other teacher I had in second grade, but she was the first one who made me feel safe in the world. And then I was at an Catholic elementary school. The principal, who came when I was 11, was Sister Vianney. And I said something to Sister Vianney one day. I have no memory of what I said to her. But she, whatever I said, she liked so much that she started inviting me to her office for conversations. Imagine the principal and an 11-year-old sitting across the desk from each other having conversation. I just remember having a wonderful time, and we laughed a lot. And at age 11, I knew, because of those conversations with Sister Vianney, who was probably middle-aged at the time, I knew she was the authority in the school. I knew that I was equal to anybody in any room. From 11 years old on, I have felt equal to anyone in any room. When I first heard about the imposter syndrome, I had to look it up, because I never felt like an imposter anywhere. And I know a lot of people have those feelings. So I recently thought of a way to help people overcome those imposter feelings. When you walk into any room, people in there are all human beings. We are all human beings. In any room you walk into, you are equal to humanity to everyone in your room. Equal in humanity. And if you can start there by seeing yourself as equal in humanity, then you could start feeling equal in other ways.
Well, yes, and that's a great place to start. Versus
right.
all of the things that the voice in our head starts telling us that they're better or we're not good enough.
Right.
And just,
right.
And, you
yeah.
know, the other thing that's really fascinating is that, you know, as we're worried about what other people are thinking, they're worried about what other people are thinking. And it's so,
yes,
you know,
they are.
They're not really thinking about us. at all.
No,
for the most
they're not.
Part.
They're thinking about how they look, or am I getting the right amount of respect, or they're not thinking about the other people. But if you walk into a room knowing you're equal in humanity, you start with a basic quality.
Yes.
And then you build
the
up.
The power of adults, that adults have with children, and it is often
yes.
one adult and one conversation. But in your case, when the principal took that extra time with you as an 11-year-old,
mm-hmm.
it made such
mm-hmm.
a powerful difference in your life. And we can do that in whatever role we're in as adults. It doesn't have to
we
be
can.
A work role.
We
it can be volunteers. It can be neighbors, kids. It can be, you know, it's having that conscious choice of, you know, how am I creating this positive interaction with this child?
And I changed the young, little girl's life with four words when I was in my 20s. I was in a laundromat in Chicago. I sat down, got my laundry going, sat down to read a magazine. Off to my side was this little blonde girl who was just hunched in a chair looking really sad. I never saw an adult with her. Over the years, I've come to decide that someone just left her there and went off to do other things. So she was just sitting in this chair by herself, looking very sad, when a Philippine woman with three little girls came in to do her laundry. She did the laundry. The little Philippine girls started playing all around the laundromat. They just went all around the laundromat. They would sort of tumble by playing in around the laundromat. And I started saying things to them when they tumbled by. The little blonde girl off to the left just watched sadly, watched me, watched the little girls. Finally, after the little Philippine girls tumbled by again, I turned to the little blonde girl and I said, "I like you too." She sat up straight, her eyes opened wide, the sun came up in her smile, and she ran off to play with the little Philippine girls, because I gave her permission to feel equal. I didn't tell her to go play with the little Philippine girls. I didn't tell the Philippine girls to play with her. I just said, "I like you too."
That's a powerful statement, because it validates that she had value when she was feeling, most likely that she did not.
Right, and it made her equal to the Philippine girls.
Yes, it did. So in your work right now with people to empower them, well, and I want to back up a minute and invite you to share in your role, you are a soft skills mastermind. Can you tell
yes.
us a little bit more about that?
I've been doing it since I was a child.
Role?
I've started teaching people what I've been doing since childhood. I have realized that using soft skills can attract unimagined success. My conversations with the principal attracted the unimagined success of never feeling the imposter syndrome. How many people can say that? Probably not many. I've attracted all kinds of other successes over the years. I attracted the correct diagnosis for my spinal injury. I had 33 years of misdiagnosis, remember, by people who got paid, and I got all kinds of diagnoses. The last diagnosis was that I was emotional, and if I just kept doing what hurt, the pain would go away. This was a physical therapist doing the functional test for Social Security disability. I told her that my spine started hurting. Well, I said back. I wasn't using the word spine then. I didn't know enough about the back in the early days, in the early years, to know which words to use. But I told her that the pain started when a boy in school pulled my chair out from under me. She ignored that. She ignored that the pain kept getting worse and worse. Like, in the beginning, I kept doing what hurt because it didn't hurt much, but it hurt more and more and more and more. Well, until sitting and standing normally became excruciatingly painful. I didn't sit, I went to college, but I didn't sit in a chair with my feet flat on the floor for any class. I sat in a special chair that was modified for me, an old rocking chair with the rockers cut off that was low to the ground, and I would sit, or I would sit on a chair with my feet on another just chair, or I sat on the floor. For one whole class, I lay on the floor because I couldn't sit normally. So she ignored all of that to tell me that all I had to do was keep doing what hurt and the pain would go away. Well, I did. What? I did a talk for a businesswoman's group in a city 2.5 hours from where I live. When I did talks, I asked to have a tall stool, and I brought my lumbar pillow with me because I couldn't just sit or stand normally. And I would explain them to the audience and say, if you have any children in your life, please tell them to never pull a chair out from under anyone. I was doing my best to stop anyone else from having that kind of injury. After my talk, a woman came up to me and told me she was a nurse. And she gave me the correct diagnosis for my spinal injury after 33 years. She told me that when I hit the floor, my spinal cord tensed up. No one had ever said anything to me about my spinal cord when I was seeing all those medical professionals who got paid. None of them, not a single one of them. She said that when I did anything that hurt, the tension in my spinal cord increased, increasing the pain and pulling my pelvis out of place. A chiropractor had, perhaps in the, let's see, about 10 years earlier, I think, a chiropractor had sent me for x-rays, and he said I had no S-curve in my spine. Now, why he didn't go further and realize that the no S-curve meant that the pelvis is out of place, I don't know. But I didn't know enough about the bone structure to ask that question. She told me that my spinal cord had tensed up, my pelvis had pulled out of place, all the pain I was feeling because the pelvis was out of place, my hips were out of place, and so, of course, my vertebrae were shifting out of place. All of these out-of-place bones. She said her husband was a chiropractor who used an unusual technique called neural organizational technique. And she said she could end the pain, he could end the pain in my spine. On the drive home, I thought about it and decided that of everything anybody had ever said to me about how to end the pain in my spine, this is the one that would probably work. So I made an appointment with him. He did not do the normal adjustment, the normal chiropractic adjustment. He had a little laser pen. He told me that the spinal cord is attached to the spine by two muscles, one in the bottom of the neck and one at the base of the spine. He's told me that both of those muscles were tensed up because the spinal cord was tensed up. He shined his laser pen on the muscle in my neck and ended 33 years of pain in my spine. The muscle
relaxed. Oh, my gosh.
The spinal cord relaxed. 33 years, and all it took was this laser pin. But, and so my pelvis shifted back into place right away. But my muscles had been doing the wrong things for 33 years. So they had to get used to doing normal, and I got the correct diagnosis for my spinal injury in 1996 and treatment. In 1991, I had a boyfriend for a short time who bought a Honda Civic, 1983 Honda Civic. I sat in his passenger seat for the first time, and the pain in my hips just disappeared instantly. So I discovered that cars' seats could hold my hips in place if they were built properly. I was poor because how do you earn money if you can't sit or stand normally? And I couldn't afford to buy the right kind of car till after my mother died. She had always made money more important than me, and I had told her I was ending my relationship with her 23 years before she died. I ended my relationship with her and told me to take me out of her will. Well, she had buried her memories of murdering me. I buried my memories of her murdering me. She buried her memories of murdering me and convinced herself that she was a good mother by keeping me in the will. So when she died, I inherited enough money to buy a Hyundai Kona SEL SUV. I did some test driving, and these car seats, she told my hips into place. In 2014, I had started writing in my journal. I write about my life in a journal since 1983. And I started recording my journal that when I did the Cobra yoga stretch, I would feel 2 to 3 bones, vertebrae in my lower back, thunk back into place. I used the word thunk because I could hear them shift back into place. I felt them, of course, and it was painful, but I could hear them. I never feel any of my vertebrae shifting out of place, but I do feel them shifting back into place. And so from 2014 into 2020, when I got my car, I would record vertebra thunks in my lower back. About 2 months after I started driving that car, the number of thunks started lessening because the seats were holding my bones in place better, so my muscles were getting better at doing normal. And I no longer feel thunks in my lower back when I do the Cobra. I still have some vertebrae shifting out of place, but it's very few compared to what it was.
That is a long journey of pain, and so excited to hear that it's
pain.
Back in
right.
place.
But it ended, and the information about neural organizational technique never came into my life in any other way. It was when I tried to prevent other people from suffering the same injury that I got the correct diagnosis. So that was an unimagined success. I never imagined when I said that to that audience that I would get the correct diagnosis and treatment for my spinal injury.
Those are what I call divine synchronicities or, that's the word that I use most often. It's that right place, right time that brings people together. And so often that comes about from, again, what we're intending to do, and in your case it was helping someone else, that brought together your solution for pain. I want to shift and talk a little bit about the title for our interview today, which is Positive Control in Small Spaces.
Right. Positive control. When you are of a childhood like mine, there are only small spaces for taking positive control. And you just have to do what you can to get up any opportunity that comes your way to take positive control. And that was usually from making a positive connection with another person, being nice to them, starting a conversation, doing something for them. Then you take positive control, and when you take positive control, you can take it in situations or relationships, then bystanders have reasons to do something for you if they like the positive control you take.
So not only are you actually taking positive control in that one-to-one conversation, or that situation with one person, it's recognizing the power that has on the observers, the bystanders
right.
around you.
Bystanders.
Who are
yes,
watching
that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the bystanders. You never know who's going to do something for you just by looking at them, either for or against you. And the way to be safest in the world is to always send out an invitation of positivity by doing what you can to make the world better in a small space, any small space.
And you've done that in a number of different ways. And when you say any small space, what are some of the small spaces that that you are referencing that people might not think of immediately?
Well, daily interactions are a wonderful source of small space successes, of opportunities to take positive control. I have no idea what I did in high school to attract this one positive reaction, but I went to a room where I had a class, and I went to my regular seat in the class, and there was this ornate mirror on the desk, a small ornate hand mirror. There were other students in the room who obviously had seen who left it, but they said nothing, and I decided not to ask, because if the person wanted me to know who she was, then she would have told me, and I didn't want to violate that. But I still have that mirror. I did something right, but I don't know what I did right, but I still have this mirror that reminds me that I did something right and made the world better for someone else in some way.
Who it was?
Yeah, I don't know who it was. I still don't know.
And doing things for others anonymously can be so rewarding as well. Because I'm sure whoever gave it to you saw your reaction, which was likely a smile.
Yes.
That's really what they wanted was to give you something that in appreciation and thanks for something that they took away from either conversation with you or where you made a difference for them. Sometimes, we want to thank the person, which mm-hmm. this story brought to mind. Someone made a donation towards my son's tuition for a program he was in, and it uh-huh. paid off the balance of his tuition.
Oh.
It was nearly $1,000. And he's like, when we were talking about it, we said, well, you could probably ask the organization if they, could let you know. And, of course, it was anonymous. And so mm-hmm. we talked about that. And, it's like he's very compassionate and very giving and very kind. And so it's, putting the thanks out to the universe and then continuing to be that strong leader, to be the role model, and to continue to make a difference wherever he could. That's how he could thank that donor.
That's right.
We can't always thank in person.
No, we can't. Two of my major life successes came from a small space success of writing letters to the editor. Two huge successes. I was poor because of my back. My husband died when our daughter was a baby, and I couldn't work because of my back, but I would not have gone to work for 40 hours a week right away because my daughter lost her father when she was a baby, so I was going to give her as much of me as I could till she started school. But I was on food stamps and rental assistance and Medicaid, and I knew a lot of other, mostly single mothers in the same position. And we were regularly out of food before the end of each month. And I heard all these stereotypes about single mothers. So I started writing letters to the editor to let people know what the reality of poverty was. And I got a lot of negative feedback. But I also got a lot of positive feedback. There was negative feedback came in the newspaper and then out in the real world. One of my friends was in a babysitting co-op. She actually went to a babysitting co-op meeting one day. During the meeting, someone said, "Does anyone here know Paula Creamer?" My friend said, "I do." And the woman asked, "Is Paula fat, and does she sit in front of the television all day eating potato chips?" Those were the stereotypes about people who said, "We need food." And a woman wrote in the paper, I wrote about being a widow. I always wrote about being a widow. Lots of these people who are negative to me had no sympathy that I was a widow with a baby. Didn't matter. One woman wrote that I was hiding behind my daughter and looking for free handouts. And a woman who worked with her called me up and said, "Don't pay any attention to her. She's just focused on money all the time." And I got other really wonderful responses. I was walking down the road in my village a little bit after I moved here, and a woman stopped me and thanked me for writing letters to the editor. I wrote about other topics, for instance, about Senator Joseph McCarthy. I live in Wisconsin, and McCarthy was a senator from here, and he was behind the Red Scare in when all the Hollywood people were blacklisted because they were supposedly communists. We're communists. They're supposedly communists. And someone had written something positive about him in the paper. So I wrote a letter. I did some research. I'm really good at research. I did some research, found that he had harmed the lives of hundreds of Americans. So I wrote that in the paper. A man called me up to thank me because he knew one of those hundreds of Americans, and her life had been seriously harmed by Joseph McCarthy. So I got all this positive feedback. While I was taking the small space successes of writing letters, I was battling binge eating disorder. I started binge eating when I was 14 to bury my feelings of living with my mother and bury the memories of her murdering me. My father chose alcohol. I chose food. I was binge eating this whole time. I wrote letters to the editor frequently for about 9 years. And 4 or 5 years into writing the letters, I realized that the compulsion to eat was fading. I wasn't binging as much. And after about 9 years, the binge eating was completely gone. This was before I was able to put the pieces of my memories together to say to myself, "Mom did try to kill me." In 1989, I was pretty much finished with binge eating. I didn't say, "Mom did try to kill me," until 1992. So the mechanism I had used to bury the memories went away because I had gotten all this positive feedback that I now realize satisfied my DISC behavior styles and guiding values. One of my soft skill study courses is teaching DISC behavior styles and spreading your guiding values so people can understand every relationship in their life. I didn't know about them until 1998, but just writing those letters satisfied those needs and passions enough that I no longer needed the binge eating. And that was just one of the successes that came from writing those letters. Another success was I had written a letter one day. Well, and my mother, I have to go back, to protect herself from what I might say as I got older, my mother convinced everyone to ignore what I said and discount what I did. She was so successful at it that I have no relationship with my siblings or any relatives on either side of the family. My father died before I ended my relationship with my mother. But after I did, the only person who made a point of staying in touch with me was my mother's older sister, who knew what my mother was capable of. She stayed in touch with me until she died. So I have no contact with anyone. So I have lived with the experience of not being able to succeed in my own family, as a member of my own family. I could not succeed as a member of my own family. And as a person with invisible pain, I was stereotyped and a single mother. I was, I was kept out. The medical professionals who misdiagnosed my injury prevented me from participating in society like most people do. I couldn't sit or stand normally. So how do you participate? So after my husband died, I thought about going to college, but I thought people wouldn't, American society wouldn't let me succeed because people had forced so much failure on me. And then one day after I'd written a letter about poverty, the phone rang. I answered it. The woman on the other end of the line asked, "Is this the Paula Kramer who writes letters in the newspaper?" Not having any idea what to expect, I said yes. And she said, "Is there anything I can do to help?" For about 14 months, that family was in our lives. The mother and her church group gave us a gift certificate to a grocery store for $40, which was a lot of money back when my daughter was young. And the teenage daughter babysat my daughter once when I had an appointment. They had us over to their house for tea. I had the woman over for tea when a stalker broke into my house, tried to break into my house, and I had the option. I was living in a mobile home park, and this man was stalking me, and his mother lived down the road, and my daughter and I lived in a mobile home that was in a half circle at the back near a wooded area, so it was a dark area. And my landlady said I could move to a different home that had become available and was right under the streetlight. So I had 4 days to move, and this woman came over and helped me clean on short notice. And then one Christmas, before I moved, my daughter and I didn't want to be in the house when over Christmas time because this man's mother was down the road. So I asked a friend of mine who was going to be out of town and who had a wood stove if I could stay in his house Christmas Eve night and feed his stove. He said, sure. So we stayed there, and because none of the beds were good for my back, we slept on the floor. My daughter was 6 years old at the time and woke up at 3 a.m. to go to the bathroom, which she did maybe 3 times a year, wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom about 3 times a year. We sat up, and there was smoke down to about 2 or 3 feet above the floor. So the pipe in the back of the stove had somehow come out of the stove, and there was smoke just pouring into the house. It was 15 below. My car wouldn't start. My old car wouldn't start. So we had to sit there for an hour with all the windows open. I did put the pipe back in on the stove. We had to sit there with the doors and the windows open to clear the house out. And the next morning, we had been planning to go down to my in-laws for Christmas. I called my sister-in-law and asked her to come and get my daughter so she could go, had her drive me home. And then I called this family up and asked, explained the situation and asked if I could come over for Christmas. And they took me right in. My older sister once said to me when I asked if I could come, if we could come for Christmas, I knew she was hesitant, so I pretended to make other plans and called again and said, "I need other plans." And she said, "We don't have any space for you." So this family who barely knew me took me in on a last-minute notice for Christmas. And because of this family, I began to feel that I was indeed part of American society and that I could go to college and succeed. So because of my letters to the editor, I ended a 25-year eating disorder, and I realized that I could go to college to succeed, and now I have 2 degrees, and I'm doing interviews, and I have an international voice because I wrote letters to the editor, a small space success.
That is such an amazing journey that you have been on in your quest to find your voice and to speak up
especially about topics that people didn't understand or only saw mm-hmm. one point of view about and either weren't mm-hmm. able, weren't willing, or were misinformed about there being another side. So being willing to offer that point of view and to know that through each of those things you gained something in retrospect. And in, a lot of times in the moment we don't know how it's going to fuel us, to give us the opportunities to move forward. And now with those 2 degrees and speaking and the programs that you have created cover quite a diversity of topics. And so I do want to talk, you have a program called, or you've done work with Girl Grit.
Right, I did a lot of research.
Can you tell us a little bit about Girl Grit?
Yes. That started in 1988. I was watching a talk show, a woman's talk show hosted by a woman, and saw the host betray a female guest. And I couldn't believe that she had done that. Couldn't understand how she could do that. So I started doing research. I was still in undergrad school. I decided to go to grad school, and I decided that my thesis would be about women as television talk show hosts. And for 2 years, I watched every talk show hosted by a woman that I could find. I watched 5 hours of talk shows a day. I no longer watch talk shows. But I would watch talk show, write down the date, the guest, and the topic, especially the expert guest. And when I was ready to start writing my thesis, I just read through those lists, looking at them. And I quickly realized there were repeating themes on these talk shows about women, what I call the cultural themes of betrayal, because we grow up learning to betray other girls and women. The cultural themes are women as mothers, women and their appearance, women as deviants, and teenage girls as threats to society. And I have collected all kinds of real-world examples for all of them. On my webpage, I have a webpage called Girl Grit, and I'll read you my definition of Girl Grit. I have to read it to make sure I go to that page. It's Girl Grit. Girl Grit is the courage to create equality for all girls and women, including girls and women who create inequality for you. Equality between men and women will follow equality between women. So if we want equality with men, we have to create equality with each other first. Even with women and girls who create inequality for us, even with women and girls we don't like. If they don't have equality, we don't have equality. And I have there are 4 girl mindsets. One of them is Girl Grit. And the second one is Girl Goodwill. I'm giving you these in the order I came up with them. Girl Goodwill is the determination to approach all encounters involving other girls and women with sincere approval and support for their positive words and actions. If they do something terrible, you don't support that, but you do support anything they do that is positive. Girl Gumption is the wisdom to admit that men deny equality to women who see men as inferior. Why in the heck would men want to share equality with women when women keep making a point that men are inferior? Why share equality? Girl Gems are positive words supporting other girls and women by putting shine on their skills and accomplishments.
Um,
Those are four very powerful, that's a word I've used a lot in this interview, but looking particularly at women and the fact that as more and more women are, excuse me, realizing that the power of collaboration and support among women is exponential. Mm-hmm. And yes. We've grown up, like you said, we've been taught to culturally, we are jealous, we are defensive, we are cautious, we are protective of our space ideas, et cetera. So we've been taught to compete with each other, which is disempowering. And when we understand yes. that when we support one another and we work together, so much more is possible. And the natural world works more on collaboration and cooperation, excuse me, than it does on competition. And mm-hmm. that is an idea that's growing and spreading. And I think even Darwin realized in his later years that his theory of evolution wasn't everything that the initial research showed it to be. I'm not sure where I heard that, but I do know that that theory about survival of the fittest particularly yes. has flaws. And so there's a lot more examples of how cooperation is beneficial. So the four mindsets of the girl mm-hmm. mindsets that you have, especially mm-hmm. if our young girls can understand that, can learn about that and can look at the world differently than through what's becoming a dated perspective, then right. what more opportunities they have individually and how much more we gain as a society when they right. do work well, together.
And I have two real-world examples where girls and a young woman lost out because of their judgments. When Lisa Kudrow of Friends was in high school, I think she was 13, her two best friends decided that it would be best if she found out what the world was like without them, and they just dumped her. Well, look at who she is now. She's Lisa Kudrow. And the actress is one of them in probably the most successful sitcom ever. And she has been on other shows, and she did Who Do You Think You Are, that series, for a while. Imagine what their lives would have been like if they had stayed her friends. They found out, instead of her really finding out what life was like without them, they found out what life was like without Lisa Kudrow. My other mm-hmm. example is a black woman named Michelle. Went to college and had a white roommate. The roommate's mother found out that Michelle was black and was horrified and insisted that the school move her daughter to a room with a white roommate. That was Michelle Robinson, who became Michelle Obama. Imagine what would have been open to that roommate if she had just stayed friends with Michelle Robinson.
And I think those two examples also highlight the idea that when we are growing up in a school situation, it's like being in a fishbowl in the perspective of it's a small space or like a small yeah. pond, and we think it's the whole world. And
right,
even though
right.
parents can mm-hmm. tell their kids, you know what, there's so much more out there beyond the walls of this building, beyond the people in this space. And I think now even with the social media can be extremely brutal because people are even more negative when they aren't face-to-face with the person they are cutting down mm-hmm. verbally or emotionally or
right.
mentally. So to understand that there are other ways of being in the world and other mm-hmm. approaches, and you provide a lot of resources for that. I do want to quickly, when we were talking, you had shared a story about men want women to stop criticizing other
All
women.
All right. Yes, they do. I'm in four books with multiple female authors, and one of them had a podcast, and I she posted about a podcast episode, and I felt I should listen to this episode. So I did, and I got this incredible quote. First, I want to give you a different quote that came from someone else I connected with. Bernadette Boas, B-O-A-S, is a former bitch. She was a corporate bitch for a long time, and she since has changed her ways. She wrote a book called Shedding the Corporate Bitch, Shifting Your Bitches to Riches in Life and Business. And in her book, she had this quote. She wrote this: "Today, large and small businesses engage me to help them find a solution to breaking the glass ceilings for the women in their organization. On one particular call, a man who headed up a large medical practice explained to me how the two women on his board of directors, both eligible to replace the CEO, were going to be overlooked because, he stated, they're bitches. The women were qualified and deserving of the position, but no one would vote them in because of their attitudes." I knew exactly what he was dealing with. That's what Bernadette said. And then there's Andrea Johnson, an intentional optimist. That's what she calls herself. She's a quote. And this proves that men want women to be nice to each other. In this quote, in this blog, in this interview that I felt I should listen to, she said, talking to women, "You are the answer. You are the future. Because I'm talking to women here, right? I mean, what's interesting is that the most people that share my podcast are men. But it is 100% geared toward and presented to women. It's all about women's leadership. But one of the things I say in there is you are role models for future generations. So men sharing this podcast want women to be nice to each other. They're sharing the podcast to convince women to be nice to each other. They don't want to hear this bitchiness."
Yeah, and it's that the, when you're talking about, in, especially in the corporate world, where women have put on a mask to try to be more masculine or compete with more masculine, what they perceive to be masculine traits or traits men appreciate, and then they deny who they are and how they would naturally lead, and that creates even more stress. As companies are recognizing that there's definitely strength in both a masculine and a feminine approach, both a there's room for some competition and some collaboration and cooperation. And in order to survive, the companies are having to pivot as well. And, oh, my gosh, time flies when you're having fun. It's 53 after the hour already, Paula. And I do want to open the lines for if anyone is listening live and they have questions for Paula, you can call 347-215-8390. And I want to give Paula an opportunity to talk about particularly she does have some free opportunities for learning from her. Would you tell us about that, Paula?
Yes. On my website, I have two self-study courses. And on my website are three lessons from those courses, one lesson from one course and two lessons from the other course that are free that can change your life, just those three lessons. One is three behavior transforming steps that tells you how you can transform someone's behavior with a real-world example. I always use real-world examples. The second one explains who is most likely to be willing to transform their behavior. There are three groups of people in our lives. There are people who get what we're doing, there are people who will never get what we're doing, and there are people in the middle who could go either way, depending upon what kind of invitation we send them. And so you maintain the relationships, you nurture the relationships of the people who get you, you are polite to the people who don't get you, to limit their backlash and to invite bystanders to be positive to you. And then you focus on transforming the relationships of the people who are in between so that they realize that knowing you is a good thing. The third video is about the three triggers that can lead to workplace violence. So if you know about these triggers, you know what you can watch for. Three beliefs that lead to workplace violence. If you know what these beliefs are, you can watch for them and take action to give people reasons to think more positively. So you can change relationships, know whom to focus on in attracting loyalty and inviting loyalty, and how to save your life in the workplace.
And the website where these are found is what?
SoftSkillStrategyCourses.com. SoftSkillStrategyCourses.com. And I have 14 blog posts. Right. I teach soft skill strategies to use with other people. I have 14 blog posts with resources for using soft skills power strategies with yourself so that you feel deserving of any unimagined success you attract. Get rid of the imposter syndrome.
To take control of making changes
right.
in your life and making
yes,
those positive changes.
Right. And both
for
men and women. One of my blog posts lists episodes from the podcast The Art of Manliness. Oh, have I learned from that podcast. That's a great podcast, my episode. You should pay attention to those episodes. Really great stuff. And he has a lot of Navy SEALs on. And one Navy SEAL talks about how the first thing a Navy SEAL does is to learn how to take control of his emotions and his instincts. So that's positive control in small spaces within you.
Yes. Truly. Well,
yes.
As I don't see any callers right now, and as we're coming down to our last few minutes, Paula, the best way for listeners to connect with you for more, I have several in the show notes, but what would you say is the best way for listeners to reach you?
My email address, paula@speakingfromtriumph.com, but on my Facebook page, if you follow me on Facebook, you'll see conversations. I try to start conversations wherever I go because I see conversations as opportunities for creating small space successes and creating new relationships. And I realize, I've been telling people that they should do this, but then I realize that most people probably don't know how to start conversations everywhere they go. So I write examples up on my Facebook page about how I start conversations, who I start conversations with, the good and the bad of the conversations. One of them is really bad, but a lot of them are good, and a lot of them are just fun. And you never know what you'll get
just,
back. When
that's right. And when we're not sure how to start or what to say, seeing examples can be very freeing to go, oh, well, I could just copy that. You could just say that and make that my starter because then I don't have to figure it out every time. And anything is easy once you do it over and over.
Right, it is. And when you have these small conversations frequently over a long period of time, you develop the confidence. You cultivate the confidence to have specific conversations with specific people for your career. You develop confidence when you talk to a lot of people. Then you're not afraid, if you have the imposter syndrome still, you're not afraid to invite the people you consider bigger than you because you've had all this practice.
Yes. So as we're coming up to the end of our time together, Paula, what are three ideas that you want listeners to take away from our interview today?
I started with taking positive control in the small spaces of my ears and my mouth, what I listen to and what I say. So I'm going to repeat this. Say, listen to positive words you can trust, speak positive words others can trust, and speak positive words to yourself. That's how I went from a child terrified of being murdered, to an international voice.
That is great. That's great advice.
And remember, Navy SEALs do that too.
Yes.
They take control of their thoughts and their emotions.
And skill. So if you think, well, I can't do that because I wasn't born with that skill, the good news is that soft skills are learnable. Learning
they
how
are.
To take control is learnable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just finding the right connections for right resources for doing so. Again,
yes.
The notes are, or the ways to connect with Paula are in the show notes, and I invite you to go to speakingfromtriumph.com or to email her at paula@speakingfromtriumph.com. And the information on from the courses with the free videos and the blog post is softskillstrategycourses.com.
Great.
Thank you so much, Paula, for spending the time sharing your story and how you have transformed your life to speaking from triumph now and the wonderful work that you're putting into the world to help others find their voices and to find that positive control in small spaces.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Listeners, please take action on something you learned or relearned from this interview that could be the spark to ignite a positive change in your life. Please share this interview with those you think could benefit as well. And until next time, please remember that you do have the power to choose to create and enjoy an amazing day as you continue to make a positive difference in the lives you touch as only you can. Until next time, stay safe and make good choices for creating the life you desire and deserve.
Thank you for listening to Spark Radio with Miss Melanie. Please share this show link with those you believe would enjoy and benefit from listening. We invite you to join us for upcoming shows with special guests and more sparks. May a spark you heard ignite a positive change in your life. Good day.